Good morning. The application period for Hawaii's 8 medical marijuana licenses starts next Tuesday. Meanwhile, the State Department of Health has already selected the company to track the product. We'll talk with BioTrack THC CEO. And the conflict over the new base in Okinawa is only one of the issues taking the attention of former diplomat, now activist, retired Colonel Anne Wright. She's briefly back in Hawaii, and we'll catch up with her later this hour. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. How many young people fall in love with music by way of a Disney movie? The Hawaii Symphony Orchestra will celebrate the melodies Disney has given us over the years. And a hidden valley on Kauai offers a place of spiritual renewal. We'll talk with the Lauai International Center's Lynn Muramoto.
That's the conversation for Thursday, January 7th. Now the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
We're moving toward implementation of a law that's been on the books for quite some time, yeah?
Well, in terms of the dispensaries part of it, yeah. And as we've been talking about for a long time now, next Tuesday would be medical marijuana licensees will be the date that they'll get their chance to apply. The application period for the 8 licenses will run until January 29th, but already in place is the company which will track the medical marijuana from seed to sale, giving real-time inventory and activity data to the Hawaii Department of Health. That $159,000 contract for the software system was awarded to Florida-based BioTrack THC shortly before the end of the year, and CEO Patrick Vo joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Well, thank you, and thank you for joining us. Obviously, you're doing well with having this contract recently awarded to you, and now it's taken effect as of, the 2nd of January. How do you, in fact, track medical marijuana from seed to sale in real time?
So our system, what happens is every single time the licensed dispensary propagates a new plant by seed or by clone, the system issues a globally unique, non-repeating identification number for that particular plant. So it acts as that plant's social security number, if you will. And at every stage in the product life cycle thereafter, where one item needs to be separately identifiable from another, the system issues a new identification number that is a child of the parent. So what happens is it creates an unbroken lineage or an audit trail from product to product, derivative to derivative, so you can backwards trace. You have an identification number. You can backwards trace it through its lineage all the way back to the plant from which it came. And you can forward trace from any plant to everywhere that currently is. So if you harvested, say, 100 grams from plant 1, 2, 3, the system would be able to tell you 65 grams are still in inventory, 30 grams have been dispensed to patients, 5 grams have been destroyed as waste. And so the system that we will be developing for the Department of Health aggregates all of the seed-to-sale data from all of the licensed dispensaries into one location so the Department of Health can have full visibility over all the plants, all of the plant matter, and all of the infused medicated products. From end to end.
So, Patrick, though, at the very, very beginning of that cycle, when you say that it's assigned a number from the very moment that it's planted, that's a human activity, though, right? That's not something that's going to be done by computer, because obviously you need a human being to be able to plant it, right?
Correct. Absolutely. So what this is the software is a digital representation of reality. So obviously there is going to be a human element involved. But if in the software system, let's say you have 2 rooms with plants. In one room, you have 300 plants registered, and in another room, you have 200 plants registered. If the Department of Health comes in for an inspection and one of your rooms is missing plants, we have a problem. If one of the rooms has too many plants and it has plants that are undocumented, we have a problem. So there is an alignment between what is actually on the floor and what is registered and represented digitally.
That would be to prevent human error or maliciousness.
Yes, exactly. It handles both. It handles both unintentional as well as intentional errors.
At that point where there would be potentially an error found, then what would happen?
That is up to the Department of Health.
In terms of the system finding that, you know, there is not the same amount of plants that should be on the floor, or there are more than that should be on the floor, is there a way that the computer system is actually going to be able to trigger that first?
So we're talking about during an inspection that the computer itself would trigger it?
Or even before an inspection, just as an ongoing way of being able to have another level of check, being able to scan the plants that were there and being able to see that all the plants that should be there are there? Or is that only going to be triggered by an inspection where that would have to go back and be done by a human person?
Right. Well, so it would require physical verification. Now, there are other checks and balances in place at various stages of the product life cycle. So let's say, for example, at the point of harvest where the cultivator weighs the plant matter wet, and then subsequently after a couple of weeks after they've dried and cured the product, they would enter a dry weight for that plant material. One of the things that the system can do is measure that the dry to wet ratio. And if it is out of a reasonable tolerance, that would definitely send an alert or be a red flag on the Department of Health side. So they could say, hey, this was measured 100 grams wet. It measures 40 grams dry. That seems incredibly unreasonable. That's something that we're going to have to investigate further. You know, what this is it is a tool that gives the Department of Health data to make informed decisions about enforcement, about compliance regarding the licensees.
It's not meant to be a fail-safe.
Well, it is a system of registration. It is a system of documentation, and so that way there is transparency in the process. But again, if somebody, it is a tool that provides data to the department so they can make informed decisions about how they enforce the rules with the licensees.
Your company has contracted with four other states. As you look at what you're doing for them and you look at what you're being asked now to do for Hawaii, are there similarities or is Hawaii a different animal entirely?
Every state is different. What's really unique about the cannabis industry is that it is so fragmented. Every state does things differently. One of the states that we have a contract with is recreational, so don't use cannabis. There are different product types. You know, some states allow for smokable bud, whereas others are strictly capsules and lozenges and infused products of that nature. Every state's going to be different. Hawaii is definitely going to have its own unique challenges that we're going to basically have to look at and tackle one at a time.
Do you see any of those going in? Obviously, you made an RFP, you were awarded the contract. You've done some real study and surveying of what Hawaii is all about and how you would have to deliver your software system here and what Hawaii might need. Do you see any of those issues that are very different that you might find that you're going to have to do some workarounds?
No, nothing to work around. The great news is that we have had so much experience with the other states. And keep in mind, though we have government contracts with four of those states, we have a second product, and that's the business system that is used by the cultivation facilities, used by the dispensary facilities to track from a business level. So they track employee accountability, they can track sales trends and things like that. And that business system is used across 23 states, D.C., Canada, Jamaica. And so we have kind of a very wide as well as a very deep experience in this industry that there's really not much that we haven't yet seen. And so we'll be able to take components that are relevant from the other states that we are doing business in and be able to create a solution that is tailored and customized specifically for the Department of Health's workflows and the rules that are in Hawaii.
All right. Well, we wish you all the best with that, and we'll see how that starts to roll out once we actually have dispensaries. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Patrick Vo is CEO of BioTrack THC. His firm's contract to track medical marijuana sales and transportation data in Hawaii in real time is the fifth state government agreement to use the company's commercial software system. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's now 8:15. Coming up, the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra offers a multimedia Disney show. But first, your backyard quiz.
The anticipation of a new Disney princess movie is exciting kids all over the country, most notably in Hawaii. That's because the new movie, Moana, is about a young Polynesian girl named Moana Waialiki, who sets out to find a fabled island in Oceania. Her movie pal is a demigod friend named Maui, voiced by Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Disney had auditioned hundreds of young girls from the Pacific Islands to find a perfect voice match for the new princess. With open casting calls for the part, needing someone who was confident, courageous, and inquisitive, the lead character's voice was eventually chosen and the part awarded to a 14-year-old girl from Mililani, Hawaii. She's, in fact, native Hawaiian herself and is happy to be representing Hawaii. We've talked about her on the show. So do you remember who Moana's voice actress is? We'll be back with the answer after a couple of conversations. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Donovan Chow from California State University, San Bernardino. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join The Conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Well, as our quiz kind of got us thinking about Disney movies and Disney music, Richard Kaufman is a kind of musical gypsy as a guest conductor for orchestras around the world. It's a job that calls for a great deal of preparation with short notice and little rehearsal time. Richard has an additional specialty, synchronizing the orchestra's performance to motion picture images projected on a screen. And all that skill will be brought to bear this weekend when he's the guest conductor for the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra's presentation of Disney in Concert, Tale as Old as Time. He's with us this morning. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. Aloha. How are you, Chris?
I'm pretty good.
Good.
Welcome to Hawaii. And you're, you know, passing through as you do in so many orchestras around the world.
Well, to say I'm happy to be in Hawaii would be one of the great understatements. When I was about to come over here and friends would say, where's your next engagement? I would say, well, it's with the... And they would say, I beg your pardon. I say, the Hawaii Symphony. And they would say, oh, right. You know, it's like I had done something wrong.
It's like people get angry at you for
they
some
do.
Reason. I don't know why
yeah.
that is. But
I didn't feel sorry for them at all.
There's no reason to. don't waste your time. But the job that you have calls for a variety of very specialized skills. And I don't just mean conducting an orchestra. I mean conducting an orchestra with very little notice and getting everybody on the same page with what? Couple of rehearsals at the most, yeah?
Well, yeah, and it's very exciting. Being a symphony conductor, you usually have a home orchestra,
right?
And then you travel around and conduct various orchestras. And this is my first time here with the Hawaii Symphony, and when Jonathan Parrish the executive director invited me here, I was thrilled because I've heard wonderful things about this group, both professionally and personally. And so I knew it was going to be a good time, and so I couldn't wait to get here. And the skills with a show like the Disney show, it's fun. We have, as you say, they're multimedia. There's some incredible video from the original Disney films. And then, of course, the music, and we have four amazing singers. It's kind of like a big Broadway show all about Disney.
Yeah.
That's really what it's like. And, you know, everybody's singing along, and it's just, it's a great experience.
The thing that I think would be especially difficult, Richard, is that one of the elements in this multimedia presentation is very fixed as to time, and by that I mean the
right.
screen presentation.
Yes, the film never changes length.
So, you know, everything else, you can be flexible with tempo and everything else, but you can't be flexible when the music has to sync up to images, right?
Right, exactly. And that's the one of the things I love about film is that, you know, there is a definiteness to length and tempo and all that sort of thing. But within the music, there is a variation that you can do as long as you start and finish at the same time and hit the places that need to be hit, you know.
That's pretty much the number one rule in music, isn't it?
And in this show, it's interesting because there's a lot of compilation in the films. It isn't just showing one scene.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we do this wonderful Disney Memories Overture, it's called, which includes music and scenes from Fantasia and Pinocchio and Bambi, Alice in Wonderland, Lady and the Tramp. And so you're taking on this wonderful journey through the history of Disney with all this great music and the visuals. And then we start going through and having various clips from different films, Tangled, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, Little Mermaid, Hercules. We have a large section devoted to the movie Frozen. I don't know if anybody's heard. There's a song out there called Let It Go.
So I'm told.
From Frozen, yes. I've heard about that.
Yeah.
And then we, of course, Lion King. And so it's basically, if you like Disney, this is really a visual and audio journey through Disney's history in a wonderful way. And with this orchestra, you know, it takes a great orchestra to play this music. And this orchestra is, you know, one of the best around. So
particularly when you mentioned that first medley, It made me think about a lot of us grew up with Uncle Walt on the TV and the Disney shows and the Disney movies that, you know, of the 50s and 60s. And they were as much about music to me as they were about images. That I think a lot of us got our, you know, got melodies stuck in our head from a Disney movie, even if there were no other sources of music coming our way.
Right. And I think a lot of people, the first classical music they may have ever heard in their lives was Fantasia.
Yeah.
And it's really a tribute to Walt Disney that he saw the entire landscape of the visual and the audio and brought it to people and was aware that the visual affected the music and the music affected the visual. And had terrific writers. I mean, the Sherman Brothers, you know, with all that they did, and then using the great classical composers.
Well, and especially when he first started out, Disney was very much a sort of a broad and visionary artist. You know, collaborating with Salvador Dali. I mean, he really was.
Yes.
He was not just trying to be a commercial success. He was really trying to bring art to the masses. You could argue that he succeeded pretty well.
He sure did. And, you know, one of the tough things for Walt Disney, I believe, was that coming together of the desire for the artistic and the need to be pragmatic in making money. A studio had to make money and exist. And then he ran into a whole union situation that turned things upside down in the business. And somehow he kept reinventing himself and never lost the vision. So when somebody says, well, I don't think we can really afford this. I mean, his brother Roy, who ran the operation, you know, when Roy would say, gosh, Walt, I don't know if we have enough. Walt would say, don't bother me now. I'm, you know, creating a Sleeping Beauty. And, you know, and when it came out, nobody really thought this would last, you know, the way it has.
I think he's overlooked as an influential artist, like a, you know, in the way that Charles Chaplin was an influential artist and at much the same era.
Yeah. And yet he's won the most Academy Awards.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty good tribute.
Well, yeah, he's a success, you know.
Yeah.
It's more in terms of the relation to the arts and music.
Yeah.
But you're going to be bringing all that to the fore this weekend.
We will. You know, I've done a lot of work at the Disney Studio, and when you walk around, you can see that this was not just a movie studio. This was like a family kind of thing that Walt Disney put together with the animators and the musicians and the crews and the actors and everything like that. And you can just feel that, you know, you're within some kind of really exciting place that did have his vision, you know, for years. And this weekend with Hawaii Symphony, this is a real tribute to Walt, and it's fun. I mean, it's for all ages. You know, a lot of parents will say, well, I'm bringing my children. Well, the truth is, they're bringing themselves, and they couldn't get a babysitter.
Children are a prop, so you can
that's right.
Enjoy it without being self-conscious.
That's
about
right.
It, right?
Excuse me. We so you know, we're really looking forward to it.
It's going to be a great show. Thanks very much for coming in.
I'm also supposed to say that tickets are still available. They are going fast.
Well,
I love doing these commercials. The shows are Friday night.
You've got a knack for it, Richard.
Thank you very
much. You know what? I've got that info here.
You did? Well, here's Chris to tell you what I was going to tell you.
And Richard Kaufman will be the guest conductor for the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra's presentation of Disney in Concert, Tale as Old as Time, at the Blaisdell Concert Hall on Friday, January 8th at 7:30, Saturday, January 9th. Wait a minute. Yeah, at 2 p.m.
Tale as old as time, tune as old as song, bittersweet and strange, finding you can change, learning you were wrong, certain as the sun, rising in the east, tale as old as time, song as old as rhyme, beauty and the beast.
Milestones and setbacks. Eric Holder looks back.
I'm not sure that race drove Congress to put in place those draconian drug sentencing laws, but I certainly know that as we look back at it now, there is certainly a racial component to it.
The former AG on racial justice and financial injustice. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
It's generally considered gauche to ask how much money someone makes, but when it comes to Honolulu government employees making six figures, well, Civil Beat wanted to know. Today, Civil Beat is publishing more salaries gleaned from its open records request, and reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
All right, so peeking into people's wallets a little bit, but then again, considering who's paying their salaries, I guess folks have a right. So who's making the money that's six figures?
Well, before I drop some names here, let me just tell you that Civil Beat feels it's very important to make sure that this information is available publicly. Salaries are by far the biggest cost of state and local government. We feel it's important for people to know where that money is going. So you can go on our website, you can check out the database, and you can search not only for city and county employees, but also state employees. We don't include the neighbor island counties, but we're working on that. So here's the name dropping. There are four Honolulu officials that make more than $200,000 a year. There are over 110 that make more than $100,000. The top earner for the city and county is the medical examiner. Christopher Happy is the top paid employee, $261,000 a year. And number two is Dan Grabowskis, a name that we all know, Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation, $257,000.
And those are just two. But a lot of people are wondering, well, what about, you know, like the police chief? What about the mayor? How do they stack
Happy
up?
Happy to share that information with you right now. Louis Kealoha, our police chief, he's at number six, $173,000. Interestingly, Kirk Caldwell, the top city official, is actually number 12 when it comes to how much he makes, $157,000 a year. By the way, you mentioned HPD. We are not allowed to list the names of the police officers. Instead, we provide a range of salaries. It's interesting, HPD is the most costly agency for the city and county, between $152 and $207 million a year in salaries.
I mean, a lot of money, and obviously the reason that we've been talking about this for a long time now is that having this database allows people to, you know, not conjecture about this, but really know where a lot of their money tax-wise is going.
Right, and I should just make clear, we're not including overtime or benefits. This is just the flat salary figure. Yeah, and we don't have all of the salary information in. We have records requests out there. We're going to be updating our database as that information comes in. And by the way, you can search by department, by name, by job, by title, a number of ways. You can actually sort the information. So it's very user-friendly, and hopefully our site won't crash. Oops, I probably should have said that. But it's a very popular feature whenever we run this because people simply want to know, sometimes for envious reasons, exactly how much money our money, taxpayer money, is going to pay for salaries.
So what's next in to be added into the database?
We're waiting for some more information. Department of Education, I believe we still haven't got that figure yet. I noticed that there were some others missing as well. And we are hoping, as I said, to include the neighbor island counties, a lot of folks employed with the government there on Maui and Molokai and Kauai and the Big Island and Lanai. So important to include them in the mix.
And how difficult has it been to get answers back once you put that request out there?
It can take a little doing. You know, records request, sometimes agencies are a little slow in getting around to it, but they have to by law. That is something they're required to do. And so we are working with them to get that information and provide it to our readers.
And make sure they understand that they're supposed to be providing that information.
Exactly. It's our money.
All right, Chad. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Beth.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, striving to increase informed discussions about life in Hawaii, around the Pacific, and the world through support of HPR's local and national news programming. More on Facebook or Matson.com.
Earlier this week, we talked about the opposition to the building of a marine base in Okinawa, where there are already dozens of military bases. Shortly afterward, retired Colonel Ann Wright contacted us that she was back home in Honolulu and that one of her recent stops had been Okinawa. The former Army veteran and career diplomat became an activist after her resignation from the government in opposition to the war in Iraq in 2003. We periodically check in with her about her activities, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
I think every time we talk to you, it's more than just a travelogue. It's a case of, has Ann gotten herself arrested again? But in this case, not. You just came back from Okinawa, and you heard our conversation earlier this week with John Lettman. You've had some other experiences there as a veteran. What have you been doing?
Well, the trip that I took to Okinawa was with a Veterans for Peace delegation, a national delegation, where we were going not only to Okinawa, but also Jeju Island, South Korea, on the issue of U.S. military bases around the world, really. And with the U.S. pivot to Asia and the Pacific, we wanted to go to those two places because there are new military installations, the one in Jeju Island being built by the South Korean Navy, or actually by the corporations led by Samsung, a naval base that now is virtually completed, a huge, huge naval base in a country that had plenty of military installations to start with, and yet it is built on a pristine island called the Island of Peace, Jeju Island. I'd been there four times with delegations in solidarity with citizen activists who said, don't build that naval base on our land. And why is it important for us as Americans is because the U.S. military ships will be using that new port as a part of the Aegis missile defense system, which the South Koreans have on their destroyers. So we wanted to go there in solidarity, even though that naval base, despite huge citizen opposition, the naval base has been built.
And that seems to be the situation that we're witnessing in Okinawa, watching what has been happening with the opposition there by citizens, by Okinawan government, the lawsuit with between Okinawa and Japan, all of that happening, and voices around the United States seemingly not being heard.
Indeed, and the Okinawan people are mounting a massive protest against the building of yet one more military base. You know, in their island, 74% of all U.S. military bases in Japan are located in Okinawa. Most of them have been there for over 70 years. And they are doing a very good job in their protest to have the governor of the island saying to the federal government, we will not give you the permits to build this. And the mayor of Nago City, where the installation will be, saying, we will not let your trucks come into our area. So now it's up to us as American citizens if we feel that another military base is in somebody else's country is something that we oppose.
And how many bases are there, U.S. military bases around the world that are in other countries?
Well, there are over 800 U.S. military bases that still survive. Back during the Cold War, we had over 1,500 military bases in other people's countries. There has been a reduction, but then in key countries such as Germany, South Korea, and Japan, the United States still maintains a large number of bases. And particularly on the island of Okinawa, the citizen opposition to those bases for a variety of reasons, but one of which has been the sexual assault and rape of Okinawan women and children. The presence of the United States military after 70 years is something that a huge number of Okinawans say, it's time that you guys figure out how to do what you need to do in Asia and the Pacific, but don't have it on our island.
As a former member of the U.S. government, is there anything that you see that isn't happening, that should be happening in terms of the opposition from citizens' organizations that would get the attention of the government in ways that maybe they're not getting now, clearly?
Well, I think in Japan, the Okinawans have definitely gotten the attention of the federal government. But here in the United States, those of us who feel that yet one more U.S. military base, and particularly in a pristine area of the South China Sea, its runways, I mean, you can kind of say, would we want to have the Japanese government come into San Francisco Bay and build some runways out in the middle of that? Or would we want a runway right in the middle of Waikiki Beach going out into the areas of the Pacific here? No, we wouldn't. And that's what the Okinawans are saying. So we in the United States need to buck up our activism with our own government. And indeed, we are. There are two cities that now have resolutions in support of the Okinawans who say no more bases here in our country, Berkeley and Cambridge. And in fact, here in Honolulu next week, we'll be having a hearing at the Honolulu City Council on Tuesday, January 12th at 1 p.m. We'll be having testimony from citizens here in our own community saying to our city council that they need to speak out on this. We'll also be having resolutions in the state legislature. Now, whether or not these resolutions will pass, we don't know, but it's the public education to let people know that the United States still has these bases.
As you are looking at this as only one of the places and issues that you follow, I want to go back for a little bit, because earlier last year we talked about the Code Pink group, which went to the Demilitarized Zone in North Korea, and that's going to come up again for you.
Yes, indeed. I was part of a 30-woman delegation to both North Korea and South Korea. One of the key organizers is Christine Ahn, right here from Honolulu. We wanted to follow on with that Women Cross the DMZ project with another project, which will involve North Korean women and South Korean women meeting in a place in Asia. We aren't disclosing where at the moment, but an opportunity for them to be able to get together again to talk about the issues of peace, reconciliation on the Korean Peninsula. And, of course, with the nuclear explosion that happened in North Korea yesterday, it's very important that we not isolate North Korea, as the international community has been doing. The six-party talks have not taken place in a long, long time, and citizen diplomacy is what we can do, so we're doing it.
Is there something that you think that, given what we saw yesterday and the fact that some of that information is very sketchy and there isn't really agreement about what happened yesterday, that of talking to these women and having these women meet, and obviously in trying to protect where and when, although it will be soon, that they will be able to affect any change at all? I mean, despite the citizen diplomacy that you've been talking about that's been running forward, but given especially what we're seeing with Kim Jong-un and the way that he's been trying to somehow, you know, make sure that we all understand that he's in power.
Well, we don't know. We don't know exactly what the relationships will be between the women, North Korean women, that will be on this delegation and the senior leadership of the government. They are approved by the government to come to this meeting, so there is some relationship. But for us, it's we would feel badly if we didn't try to do something. And you never can tell where there may be a breakthrough. So we want to have these discussions. The North Korean women and South Korean women actually met in December in Kaesong in North Korea, two groups of them. They will probably not be the same women, but the fact that women are meeting, and you just never can tell where this may lead. So rather than just saying we won't have anything to do with North Korea, we're going to isolate everyone, we feel that engagement is the way to do it, and we urge our country, rather than to just say, just to pillory and isolate North Korea, we've got to continue a very difficult dialogue.
It's sort of back to that idea that it's better to light a candle than curse the darkness.
Indeed.
With all the things that you've been doing and more that we haven't even discussed, do you at all fear for your safety these days?
No, not really. We do some very controversial things, and we are in the face of our own U.S. Political establishment, as well in the faces of the governments of some other countries. But if you let that deter you from what you think is right to do, then you'll be paralyzed. And I don't want to be paralyzed, so I don't worry much about that.
Or care about the size of that FBI file.
That's right. I think it's probably getting pretty big now.
Ann Wright, thanks so much for checking in.
Thank you.
Retired Colonel Ann Wright is a 29-year veteran of the U.S. Army and Army Reserves. She was also a U.S. diplomat for 16 years with U.S. embassies around the world. And in March 2003, she resigned in opposition to the war in Iraq. Since then, she's been challenging many U.S. policies on national security issues. She's also the co-author of a book, Dissent, Voices of Conscience.
Good morning, I'm Scott Rowland from the University of Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
And now we're going to get back to our backyard quiz. Now, earlier today, we asked if you knew the name of the young girl who was recently cast in Disney's newest film about a Polynesian princess. She was born on the Big Island. Now she lives in Mililani. She attends Kamehameha schools and sings soprano in the concert Glee Club. Rachel Sutton, the film's casting director, said that this young girl was the last one who came in for an audition, and her personality and enthusiasm blew away the casting crew. At a big surprise reveal, high school sophomore Ali'i Carvalho learned that she got the part, and she says that in voicing this Disney character, she's just being herself and proud not to have to fake any excitement or joy. The movie is set for a Thanksgiving release.
And Beth Ann Venus from Pearl City knew the name of this future celebrity, and congratulations, Venus. That's today's quiz, and if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, announcing their annual Literacy Leadership Conference and student celebrations, February 1st through 4th on Kauai, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Those of us who are city dwellers may forget that there are such places in Hawaii. places of complete serenity where you can tune into the sound of the wind and feel a connection to the spirit within. The Lawai'i International Center on Kauai is described as a gathering place for all people to hear what is not said, see what cannot be seen, to feel what cannot be touched, to know peace, and to receive the true spirit of aloha. The Lawai'i Valley has been home to shrines from Hawaiian, Taoist, Buddhist, and Shinto traditions, and the center continues in that ecumenical spirit. Lynn Muramoto is the board president, and she joins us by phone. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning.
You have the enormous advantage of being in a beautiful setting, don't you?
Oh, well, we are all blessed to be here.
And tell me about where you are, which is where?
Oh, we are in Lawai, which is about 20 minutes southwest of Lihue.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What's it like there?
Well, it's more the feeling here at the center. As soon as one sets foot on the grounds, what they're feeling is something way beyond. We have 88 shrines on the hillside, and we have a new building, but they're feeling way beyond these structures.
Mm-hmm.
They're feeling the heart and soul of the community and the collective consciousness of this community.
What do you think has brought that about, Lynn?
Well, historically, on this sacred grounds, first the Native Hawaiians came here, and for the Native Hawaiians, this area is a turtle. When you come to the grounds, there is, a rock wall that forms the front fins of the turtle, and the hillside is the back of the turtle.
Uh-huh.
Then when the first wave of Japanese immigrants came to the islands, the first group, they were young teenage farmers. And they set sail with hopes in their hearts for a better life on this island and landed on the sugar plantations, and worked on the sugar plantations of Kaloa. And they, too, could feel the energies of this place and built these 88 shrines on the hillside. And each little shrine represents a much larger temple in Shikoku, Japan, where there are 88 large temples around the island.
What it sounds like, Lynn, is that a great deal of, for want of a better term, spiritual energy has kind of converged in this valley.
Yes, and nature has provided these places of comfort, and they're found all over the world. And at the same time, it takes the openness and the commitment of the hearts of the people to open up these natural energies.
Go ahead.
May I continue with the shrines?
Please.
And so what happened was after the shrines were created in 1904, people walked from all parts of this island for 50 years. It was from 1904 to the late 40s. And so it was very common that people would walk from Hanalei, which is on the total opposite end of the island, and walk barefooted for their journey to this land for their miracles. And so one woman named Grandma Nonaka came here every month for over 60 years, and before her sons went off to war, she took a pinch of the soil and put it in a Bull Durham tobacco pouch and pinned it onto her sons.
Huh.
And when they returned safely, they were to return the pouch of soil. And so today, the soil has gone to Iraq and back many a time.
Uh-huh.
Yes, and so one woman said not only did her friend feel that this pouch of soil from Lawai, helped him to return safely, but his entire unit held this one pouch of soil.
You know, Lynn, with places that are described as sacred places or places of healing, the place that you're describing, the Lawai Valley, sounds as if it always, in the perception of people there, always had that. But do you think that the presence of people and the kind of the energy that people put into a place like yours can change it over the years? Can a place can be sort of invested with that kind of spiritual energy?
Definitely. When we went there, what happened was historically there was a plantation camp there, and They worked on the people worked on the pineapple cannery, and the cannery closed, so the people moved from there. And with it, overnight, this place became an entire jungle, overgrown jungle for decades. And so when we came along in 1990, 25 years ago, we literally went in with chainsaws, and with the chainsaws cleared the ground, rebuilt this rock wall to open up the energies.
Mm-hmm.
And when we did this, they called us the No-Can Project. They said it's impossible. And so after clearing the grounds, the landowner wanted to develop the place. And so we asked him how much did he want for the 32-acre parcel. And he wanted $6 million. Well, that didn't stop our little group. We went to the county fair and made the largest malasada booth in the history of the county fair. And we made 28,000 malasadas.
Yeah.
Then we made 8,000 plates of stew and noodles at another event. And then Grandma made her own mango preserves, and we sold over 10,000 bags of those. So we just kept going on and on, and going the best way we knew how, until about 15 years ago, everyone's a volunteer in the organization, from the ladies who sweep the floor through administration.
Lynn, we've run out of time, but...
You're kidding.
Well, that's how time...
Anyways, I think people will need to come over and experience it, but
it certainly sounds that way.
Did happen, and could I just finish this one story?
No, we're out of time.
Okay.
Thanks very much for talking with us, Lynn. Lynn Morimoto is the board president of the Lawai International Center in Kauai, and Shakuhachi Grandmaster Riley Lee will perform two concerts of Shakuhachi, the ancient ceremonial Japanese flute, at the Center's Hall of Compassion on January 16th, and you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bronster Fujichaku Robbins, a civil litigation law firm handling major cases on all islands for clients of all sizes, from individuals to Fortune 500 corporations. BFRHawaii.com.
This week on Radiolab, join us for an argument with time.
Most people do not need to live in the present. Most people don't need to live in the present. Everybody doesn't need to live in the present. Through living in the past, I find secrets.
Time has its secrets. We learn a few.
That's too weird.
It's on Radiolab.
Saturday morning at 10, following the splendid table.
Beth Ann, we're city dwellers, for want of a better term, and we're caught up in the things of morning traffic and, you know, the things that city folk deal with. And so thinking about a place of serene retreat on Kauai, we all need to do more of that. It's hard to find opportunities.
Sometimes you just have to sort of bring up a very pretty picture on your screen and pretend.
That's right. That's right.
Especially for those of us who make our lives in the city and are bound to them in ways that maybe we should think about sort of untying. But for the moment, we are all here with you, and we will be back tomorrow. Now, a quick program note for today, though. You might have noticed that we didn't talk about what's coming up on Town Square tonight. That's because we're preempted. We're going to be airing a rebroadcast of Howard's New Year's special, just in case New Year's morning found you a little too tired to pay attention and tune in. You get another chance tonight. Now, on tomorrow's agenda on The Conversation, we're going to have a chat about retail merchants wrapping up what was not necessarily a great holiday season. We'll find out more, and we'll also see what happened with the Council on Revenues.
And a Hawaii Island artist is offering a workshop in Japanese woodblock printing at the Volcano Art Center.
If you want to be in touch, the best way is our talkback line, 808-792-8217.
And you can find past shows on hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning right here for more of The Conversation.